There's an individual in the Bible that I found to be pretty fascinating, someone about whom we rarely, if ever, preach. I'm guessing that the person I want to talk about for about the next hour, well, I don't know, maybe some of you have heard a sermon or a Bible study about this individual. He's someone who's pretty clearly depicted. He's somebody who comes on the scene in a critical time in the history of God's Old Testament nation. Someone from whom we can learn an awful lot. There's a pathetic quality to this individual. He was not successful in what he did. He was, in fact, pretty roundly a failure. And yet sometimes when we study the history of people who didn't fulfill what they should have done, we can learn from the lessons. Now in Revelation 5 and verse 10, as you know, let's maybe start out there. Revelation 5 and verse 10. Revelation chapter 5 and verse 10. The church here is likened to kings and priests. Revelation 5 verse 10, we're just picking one of the verses that essentially say the same thing, and have made us, I'm interrupting the context here, and have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth. So when we read the stories of kings back in the Old Testament, there's always something to be learned there. This king is fairly clearly depicted. His actions, his inaction, his failures, and the opportunities that he could have taken. Now, hopefully I've got your curiosity, right? Maybe you know who I'm talking about. Maybe you don't know who I'm talking about, because I told a few of you before services, so you've got to jump on that. But I'd like to go to 2 Chronicles chapter 36. 2 Chronicles chapter 36, because I'd like to talk about this man, who for me is one of the more fascinating individuals in the entire Bible. 2 Chronicles 36, and we'll pick it up in verse 11. 2 Chronicles 36 and verse 11 through verse 14. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He did evil in the sight of the Eternal his God, and did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke from the mouth of the Eternal. Also he rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who had made him swear an oath by God. But he stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against the turning to the Lord God of Israel. Moreover, all the leaders of the priests and the people transgressed more and more, according to all the abominations of the nations, and defiled the house of the Lord, which he had consecrated in Jerusalem. Just four verses dismissing this rather interesting individual, who, as it turns out, is the last king of Judah. He's the 19th of the chain of kings of Judah after King Solomon. The dates he reigned, for those who are history buffs, were 597 through 586 B.C. Now, of course, that date, 586 B.C., I hope rings a bell for all of us, because 586 B.C. is generally agreed to be the time that Jerusalem fell. It was a catastrophe. It was an absolute disaster when the nation was destroyed by the Babylonians. And one of the things that we do in the classroom, I don't show a lot of Bible movies. I like to carefully vet them before we show them, because as you probably know, a lot of the Bible movies are a little bit inaccurate. They embellish the Bible, or they go off on all kinds of things that are not accurate. But we show the movie about Jeremiah, and it's got some wonderful, colorful parts to it, where right at the end, Jeremiah sort of looks back at Jerusalem, and it's burning. And when Nebuchadnezzar came through and destroyed the city of Jerusalem and destroyed the Jewish nation, it left a huge scar, one that in some ways is with us even to this day. So we're reading here, we're going to read about the last 11 years of the nation of Judah, 597 to 586 B.C., a time of huge crisis. Now, if you want to see a parallel with our times, fine, because I think there are lessons here, and there are things that we can glean and maybe implications that we can gather for political and national leaders, but surely there's a lot for us to learn here as well. It was the time of the Babylonian captivity, and, you know, the Babylonian captivity kind of came in waves. Daniel ended up in the captivity very early, going into captivity somewhere around 605 B.C. That's a good bit before the final fall of Jerusalem. In one sense, he didn't see the worst of it. King Jehoiachin, the second to last, not the third to last, if you can put it that way, the second to last of the kings in Jerusalem, reigned very briefly in 597 BC. And then Zedekiah comes to the throne, reigning for 11 years until 586 BC. Babylon was eating up Judah. Now, last summer, I had the privilege of going to Israel with a group of church members. And you know what it's like when you get off the plane. We had a flight from Newark, New Jersey into Israel, Tel Aviv, Israel. And we got off the plane, I think it was early in the morning. And they couldn't get us to the hotel because the hotel rooms are not open yet. So they put us on the buses. And the first stop that we made, and I was really glad that we did it, even though everyone was feeling sleep-deprived and thirsty, but we stopped off at Lachish. You've probably heard of Lachish. Back in the 20th century, there was a famous archaeological discovery, the Lachish letters, and I intended to bring them with me. I've got them in a book at home, and I forgot to do that. But the very famous Lachish letters, the Babylonians are coming in, and from Jerusalem, as you look outward, you can see that ring of towns south of Jerusalem, and letters are going back and forth, and correspondence goes back and forth, and it's really terrifying. Because one of the commanders in Jerusalem writes to another commander, and he says, as he's looking out from Jerusalem, the signal fire has gone out. The signal fire was this torch, this fire that burned on the walls of the city, and the fire indicated, we're still here, we're still alive and kicking. And yet the fire at Lachish was put out, and the fire at Azekah was put out, and one or two of the other cities, and they were the cities that ring the city of Jerusalem on the south side. And the man on the throne, when all of this takes place, at a time of huge crisis, was this man Zedekiah. When we visited Lachish, just after getting off the airplane last year, that they took us to see the siege mounds. You know, they built cities layer upon layer, and the archaeologists call this a tel, T-E-L. It was layer upon layer as every empire came through, and they built on top of where it had been before, and of course somebody had come through and destroyed it. But they showed us the mounds. It's a big mound of earth, and they had us climb up the mound of earth and come to the top, and you can get a pretty good view of the valley from Lachish. And then what they did in ancient warfare, as you may be aware, the cities were often walled. There was a wall around the city. And to break in, you had to begin kind of pounding away. And the invading power would take tree trunks. And with the tree trunks and their strong military men, bang, 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 bashing away, banging away at the walls and preferably at the gates of the city because that was the weakest point. And all of a sudden, the gate collapses and in come the Babylonian military men screaming bloody murder. And that was what was going on when this man, King Zedekiah, was on the throne. You would think that in circumstances like that, the best thing to do would be to look away from military solutions to your problems and look to God to save you. But it begins to get a little bit complicated. Let's just recap some of the history. We were discussing this yesterday over lunch. We were talking about history. We've got a church member there in Dallas who's got a PhD in history, Mark Morris, and he said he was fascinated by history. I told him I never liked history until I began teaching Old Testament. Then finally I figured out why history. You've got to understand something about history, otherwise you can't understand the Bible. You remember the name, of course, of the last great reforming king of Judah, Josiah, the guy who very energetically pulled down all of the elements of the pagan worship. He tore down all of the idols and all the rest of it, King Josiah. And after King Josiah, there are four kings who come to the throne. One of Josiah's sons, named Jehoahaz, comes to the throne, and he's carted off to Egypt. He only was on the throne for about 3 months. After him, King Jehoiakim. You may remember Jehoiakim. This was the guy who took the scroll, very famously took the scroll of Jeremiah's preaching, and it says in the Bible that it was the winter, Jehoiakim was sitting in his winter palace, and he took a penknife, And as they read the scroll to him with all these warnings about the curses and the disaster that was going to come on the nation, Jehoiakim took a penknife and cut the scroll into pieces and threw bits of it into the fire. Very colorful, and it was a terrible affront, and very much unlike his father, King Josiah. Jehoiakim was on the throne for about 11 years and then carted off to Babylon. And then, interestingly enough, the throne comes down one generation from King Josiah and then Jehoahaz, who's on the throne briefly, and then Jehoiakim, a very evil king who reigned for 11 years. And then the throne goes down one generation for reasons that are not completely clear in the Bible to King Jehoiachin, the second to last king of Judah. And he was a grandson of King Josiah. But he's only on the throne for 3 months, and then the Bible tells us that he did something to displease the Babylonians. You did not cross the Babylonians back then. It was something you didn't do. He crossed the Babylonians, Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, in some way, shape, or form. He was carted off to Babylon. And finally, the third of Josiah's sons, although he wasn't the third in age succession, but Zedekiah comes to the throne. And the interesting thing, of course, is Zedekiah is the uncle to the guy who was on the throne before him. Jehoiachin on the throne for 3 months, and Zedekiah probably thinking to himself, you know, I don't really want that role. I think I'm off the hook, because the throne has gone downward one generation. And yet, he's forced to the throne in one sense, because actually it was the Babylonians who put him onto the throne, and he reigned then for those fateful 11 years. How to describe Zedekiah? The Bible, you can check 2 Chronicles chapter 36, it describes all four of these kings as being evil in God's sight. They were bad kings. After Josiah, there was no righteous king. Everything goes downhill. It all goes down the drain from that point on. And yet, Zedekiah was not an evil king in the same way that Jehoiakim was. Jehoiakim was nasty evil. He was conniving evil. He was open rebellion against God. It was dangerous to be a prophet of God during Jehoiakim's reign. He didn't know whether you'd get off with your life. He was the guy who tried to destroy a portion of the word of God when he cut up that scroll, very famously, and tossed it into the fire. Zedekiah comes to the throne after Jehoiakim, reigns like him 11 years, and as the Bible says, he was an evil king, but it was a little different. He wasn't, how should we put it, he wasn't vicious evil. He was passive evil. If you study his life, he was passive evil. He never quite had the courage to do what was right. And ironically, actually, that name Zedekiah was given to him by the Babylonians. Zedekiah means God is righteous. What was he thinking? You know, I'm not going to have to worry about it. My nephew is on the throne. I'm fine. I can relax and enjoy my life. Everything's going well. Lesson number one, and we're going to cover a number of lessons from the life of King Zedekiah in the sermon. Lessons number one, responsibilities in serving God's people sometimes come unexpectedly. Zedekiah was the uncle. He thought it was over. He didn't think he needed to worry about it. And although the Bible doesn't say so, I think we're on pretty safe ground in saying he didn't want to be king of Judah. And all of a sudden it comes his way, whether he liked it or not. Let's turn to 1 Samuel chapter 9. 1 Samuel chapter 9. Because we've got another example here in the Bible of unexpected responsibility suddenly falling on someone. Responsibilities in leading and serving God's people can come unexpectedly. 1 Samuel chapter 9, and you're familiar with this story. Here's Samuel, prophet, kingmaker, power behind the throne, and he's anointed. He's about to anoint one individual to be the king. 1 Samuel 9 and verse 17. 1 Samuel 9 and verse 17. Let's read this here. When Samuel saw Saul, the Eternal said to him, "There he is, the man of whom I spoke to you. This one shall reign over my people." Unexpected. It says at one point Saul was kind of hiding out amongst the baggage. Verse 20. 1 Samuel 9, verse 20. As for your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, don't be anxious about them, for they have been found. And on whom is all the desire of Israel? Is it not on you and on all your father's house? Verse 21. Saul answered and said, am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family of the least of the families of the tribes of Benjamin? Why do you speak like this to me? Why are you saying these things to me? Answer, because God had chosen him to be the king over Israel. And of course, we know the story. But I think it's interesting, we won't take a lot of time to turn there, but of course we remember what happened with Saul and how really he was a failure. And then God says, no, I'm going to send you to find a man after God's own heart. You remember that? And he goes to Jesse's family. He finds the family, and here's all these big, tough guys who are, you know, healthy and handsome and strong. And, you know, if there were gyms back then, they were working out in the gym the whole time. And God says to him, no, not this one. Well, how about this one? No, not this one. Well, how about this one? No, not this one. And here's this kind of freckle-faced kid who's been out being a shepherd. And God and Samuel says, no, surely it can't be him. Yep, sure enough, it's him. Responsibilities sometimes come unexpectedly. You're probably aware of the fact that we recently had a very sad decease of one of our church pastors in Latin America. Probably most of you didn't know Manuel Quijano. Manuel Quijano, I remember him when he came to Ambassador College. He had limited knowledge of English, but very committed to the church, did his studies at Ambassador College back in the 1990s, as I recall, and then was pressed into service and became a very, very good church pastor in Peru. Peru is not an easy country in which to pastor. It's quite challenging in many ways. The geography is tough. There's crime in Peru. There are dangers in the cities of Peru. And he served for, what was it, I think 22 years was the time that was given. He was 54 years old, very, very sad. Been very hard on his family. Then after his decease, we've got an elder there who has now been named as interim pastor. And I'm sure he was hoping that mantle would not fall on him. But sometimes these things happen. Sometimes opportunities come along or responsibilities come along that we don't anticipate. There's a very famous quote from the 1960s, just before the outbreak of the Six-Day War in the Middle East. And it was a time of crisis in Israel because the Arab nations wanted to make war against Israel and wipe the Jewish state off the face of the earth. And they suddenly brought together a coalition government. All the different parties got together. Political parties in Israel, not very good at that kind of thing. They only do it when there's a crisis. But the person who was selected to be the national leader was a woman who's, she's deceased now, but very, very famous, Golda Meir. And there's a very famous quote from David Ben-Gurion, who was one of the founders of the State of Israel. And he said to Golda, famously, he said, Golda, you're the best man for the job. Sometimes things go that way. She was the best man for the job and a very unusual person. Zedekiah, for him, his life was difficult. Jehoiachin is coming back. That's what they believe. Jehoiachin is coming back. In addition to that, what made life difficult for him was, and you can see this very clearly in the Bible, that within Zedekiah's administration, among his advisors, there was a group of people who were telling him the wrong thing. You remember what they told him? The prophets make this very clear. For decades and centuries, the prophets of God told Israel and Judah, don't rely on Egypt. Remember that? Don't rely on Egypt. And the movie that we show in the classroom about Jeremiah depicts rather well the huge pro-Egyptian pressure inside of King Zedekiah's administration. Egypt over in the west was a constant magnet. And the Judean kings thought, well, Egypt will get us off the hook. They'll save us from the Babylonians. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 31. Isaiah 31 says this in many places. Isaiah 31, verses 1 through 3. Isaiah 31, verse 1. Isaiah said it. Jeremiah said it later on. Isaiah 31, verse 1, "Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses." Don't rely on horses. The kings were told back in the book of Deuteronomy, don't rely on horses. Rely on God. Don't rely on horses. Don't rely on your military strength. "Who trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong, but who do not look to the Holy One of Israel, nor seek the Eternal. Yet he, God, also is wise and will bring disaster and will not call back his words, but will arise against the house of evildoers and against the help of those who work iniquity." Verse 3. "Now the Egyptians are men and not God, and their horses are flesh and not spirit. When the Eternal stretches out his hand, both he who helps will fall and he who is helped will fall down. They all will perish together." And it's interesting at this phase in history, Egypt is kind of a waning power. Babylon becomes very powerful, is moving upward. And it's almost a kind of a deception. They keep looking westward toward Egypt. Egypt will save you. Egypt will save you. God says, no, Egypt is not going to save you. Isaiah said, no, don't rely on Egypt. Jeremiah said, no, don't rely on Egypt. And the pressure inside the royal court of that last king of Judah to rely on Egypt, if you read between the lines, was enormous. It was huge. Lesson here for us. Lesson for us. Jeremiah chapter 27, Jeremiah says the same thing. This is all ancient world geopolitics, but I think there is a big lesson. Jeremiah 27, beginning in verse 12. Let's read Jeremiah's statement on this. Jeremiah 27, verse 12. "I also spoke to Zedekiah, king of Judah, according to all these words, saying, bring your necks under the yoke of the king of Babylon and serve him and his people and live." Jeremiah's advice, or more accurately, God's advice through Jeremiah was, don't buck the trend. You buck the trend, Babylon's too powerful. You buck the trend, your nation's going to be destroyed. Now, this guy Zedekiah was on the scene at a critical moment. Verse 13, "Why will you die, you and your people, by the sword, by the famine, by the pestilence, as the Eternal has spoken against the nation that will not serve the king of Babylon? Therefore, do not listen to the words of the prophets who speak to you, saying, you shall not serve the king of Babylon." And if you've read the book of Jeremiah and you get the impression, there's lots of false prophets, loads of them, dozens, hundreds. And Jeremiah is almost a lone voice, a true prophet of God. And part of what he says is, no, Egypt's not going to get you off the hook. Don't listen to the words of the prophets who speak to you saying, you shall not serve the king of Babylon. They prophesy a lie to you. I have not sent them, says the Eternal, yet they prophesy a lie in my name that I may drive you out and that you may perish, you and the prophets who prophesy to you. Jeremiah, as God's mouthpiece, warns King Zedekiah, and he says, look, the eventual outcome of a pro-Egyptian policy is going to be a catastrophe. Going to be a catastrophe. And one of the reasons that it says that Zedekiah was such a bad king is because he couldn't stand up against the pressures in his royal court. Lesson? Lesson for us, and I think it's one, I hope it's one that we all understand well, and that is that sometimes Christians have to swim against the tide. Sometimes we've got to resist the pressures. And we come across this all the time, don't we? Somebody at work asks us to do something or say something that's not completely honest. Someone in school is doing something or saying something, and they want you to follow along with them. But sometimes we simply have to stand up and say, no, I can't go along with this. Exodus 23, verse 2 makes this point very clearly. Exodus 23, verse 2, and it can be hard, can't it? Because, you know, we all would like to just go along with what's going on around us. Exodus 23, verse 2. Let's read verse 1 as well, Exodus 23, verse 1. "You shall not circulate a false report. Don't put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness." There can be lots of unrighteous witnesses. Don't you do that. Don't join them. Don't follow a crowd to do evil. Don't follow a crowd to do evil. Sometimes that's harder than we think. We read that scripture and we think to ourselves, no, I'm not going to follow a crowd to do evil. And yet sometimes circumstances come along in life and it's almost like a giant flood. You ever experienced that? And to tell the crowd, I'm not going to go along with you in this, whatever it may be, I won't follow along with you, can be pretty hard. And it comes at us in different ways. It comes at us different ways and different angles at different moments in life, different ages, different situations. Don't follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. Christians sometimes have to swim against the tide. Leadership isn't always popular. Leadership isn't always popular. Serving God isn't always popular. But sometimes we have to take the stand that Zedekiah didn't do. Now, there's an interesting little twist in what we've already talked about with regard to Zedekiah, because the Babylonians surrounded the city and they began laying siege to the city. And if you've read the book of Lamentations recently, I know it's probably not your favorite book of the Bible because it's not a happy read, is it? It's a miserable read. And yet we need to read it every now and then for a number of reasons. For one thing, it's dual. It does describe the time of the Great Tribulation ahead of us. But for another thing, it shows the consequences of not making the right decisions. For Zedekiah, it got a little bit confusing. Jeremiah told him what to do. Don't rely on Egypt. Don't look toward the west. God will save you. Egypt won't. And yet something very strange happened during those 11 years, sort of in the just toward the end of the 11 years. And that is that the Babylonians who had surrounded the city of Jerusalem suddenly were gone. The siege was lifted. And you know what they were saying inside of Zedekiah's court? The pro-Egyptian folks inside of the court were saying, ah, we told you so, your majesty, if they called him that. We told you so. The Babylonians have gone. Egypt is where our salvation is. And it was really kind of deceptive because at this critical moment, the Egyptians, this waning power, mustered their strength. And guess what? The Babylonians were gone temporarily. This took place around 588 BC. Jeremiah 37, verses 5 through 8. This is a fascinating little twist. Jeremiah 37, verse 5. Jeremiah 37, verse 5. Then Pharaoh's army came up from Egypt. And when the Chaldeans, that's the Babylonians, who were besieging Jerusalem, heard news of them, they departed from Jerusalem. This was roughly 2 years before when Jerusalem fell. 2 years. And the Babylonians were gone. And all of those pro-Egyptian phony counselors inside of the king's body of administrators are now saying, we told you so. We're okay. The Babylonians have gone. The Egyptians got us off the hook. Verse 6, then the word of the Eternal came to the prophet Jeremiah, saying, thus says the Eternal, the God of Israel, thus you shall say to the king of Judah, who sent you to me to inquire of me. There's an interesting relationship between Zedekiah and Jeremiah. He kind of sneaks in there at night, almost like in the New Testament. Name escapes me. Anyway, continuing here in verse 7. Behold, Pharaoh's army, which has come up to help you, will return to Egypt to their own land, and the Chaldeans shall come back and fight against this city and take it and burn it with fire. Thus says the Lord, do not deceive yourselves, saying the Chaldeans will surely depart from us. They will not depart. For though you had defeated the whole army of the Chaldeans who fight against you, and there remained only wounded men among them, they would rise up, every man in his tent, and burn the city with fire. God purposed that the city of Jerusalem was going to be brought down because of its sins. And yet at this moment in history, it looked very, very deceptive. And Zedekiah's reaction? He vacillated. Zedekiah, is an object lesson in vacillation. He was not a good leader. And he couldn't at that juncture make up his mind exactly what he wanted to do. and he had great difficulty being steady and consistent in his leadership of the nation, and it came down to a disaster. 2 Kings chapter 24, verse 20. 2 Kings 24, verse 20. Second Kings chapter 24 and verse 20. When we read that summary statement about Zedekiah in Chronicles, it made an interesting point that the sin that he committed was not just against God. In a sense, it was also against Babylon. Why? Why? Because actually, early in his reign, Zedekiah made a commitment, and the commitment was to pay tribute to Babylon. And Jeremiah said, yep, you're doing the right thing. Pay tribute. Pay tribute. This is the right thing to do. 2 Kings 24, verse 20. Because of the anger of the Lord, this happened in Jerusalem and Judah, that he finally cast them out from his presence. Then Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. What did he do? He actually gave his word. He gave his word to the king of Babylon, and he said, I'm going to bring tribute to you. And then he reversed himself. Now, again, there's a very important lesson here, and that is, of course, when you give your word on something, you stand by it. One of the things that we're told in the last days is that people will give their word and not stand by it. Truce breakers. Truce breakers. Jeremiah's advice all the way through this was submit to Babylon. Don't buck the trend. Ezekiel chapter 17. Let's turn to the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel 17. Verses 18 through 20, Ezekiel 17, verse 18. Look at what it says here. This is talking about King Zedekiah. Ezekiel 17, verse 18. Since he despised the oath by breaking the covenant, Zedekiah made a promise. He told the Babylonians he'd bring tribute, and then he reversed himself. And he reversed himself for a particular reason. And in fact, gave his hand and still did all these things, he shall not escape. One of Zedekiah's sins was breaking his word. He was a truce breaker. He was a covenant breaker. Therefore, thus says the Lord Eternal, as I live, surely my oath which he despised and my covenant which he broke, I will recompense on his own head. Verse 20, I will spread my net over him and he shall be taken in my snare. I will bring him to Babylon and try him there for the treason which he committed against me. Zedekiah broke his word. He stopped paying tribute. He was a truce breaker. Psalm 15, verse 4. Psalm 15, verse 4. One of the big lessons in life, you give your word on something, you follow through. Psalm 15 and verse 4. Psalm 15, verse 4. Let's look at Psalm 15, verse 1, because it's a very interesting little psalm here. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? Whom do you approve? Who's going to be in the kingdom, if you want to put it that way? Psalm 15, verse 4. In whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. One of the qualities of Christian character. You give your word, you follow through on it. Zedekiah could not do that. But there was a reason for that. There was a reason why Zedekiah did what he did. I mentioned that date a few minutes ago, that something took place right at that moment when the siege was lifted. The Babylonians had surrounded the city. It looked as if it was curtains for Jerusalem. It was going to be over. But something odd happened, and it's recorded in the scriptures. Let's turn back to the book of Jeremiah, chapter 34. Jeremiah, chapter 34. Jeremiah 34. Let's pick it up in verse 8. Jeremiah 34 and verse 8. As we've already noted, this was a very weak leader, and he couldn't make good decisions. The movie that we show, which kind of fills in a lot of blanks. You know, the movies embroider what's actually in the Bible quite a bit, but it shows his advisors getting frustrated with him because he won't quite do what they want him to do. Jeremiah 34, verse 8. This is the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord after King Zedekiah made a covenant with all the people who were at Jerusalem to proclaim liberty to them. This was one of the decisions that Zedekiah made, and it was actually a good decision. And what he said was, we're going to free the Hebrew slaves. Now, that was required in the law. Every 7 years, or every 50th year, the Hebrew slaves who had, you know, they hadn't done well financially, they'd become indentured servants and so on, they've lost their liberties, and they were to be given their freedom. And this was very good in God's sight. He gave them their freedom. Verse 9, that every man should set free his male and female slave, a Hebrew man or a woman, that no one should keep a Jewish brother in bondage. Now, when all the princes and all the people who had entered into the covenant heard that everyone should set free his male and female slaves, that no one should keep them in bondage anymore, they obeyed and let them go. But afterward, they changed their minds and made the male and female slaves return, whom they had set free, and brought them into subjection as male and female slaves. This is all right around that same point when the Babylonian siege was lifted. The Babylonians were gone, and Zedekiah reversed himself. He said, we're going to grab the Hebrew slaves, we're going to bring them back into captivity, and you can read the remainder of Jeremiah 34, and it elicited from God through Jeremiah perhaps the most powerful prophecy in the entire book. In fact, really, it kind of set the seal on things for Zedekiah. God was very angry. You don't do that. What happened? The siege was lifted. Zedekiah said, I'm off the hook. I don't have to worry about it. And they grabbed the slaves and brought them back into captivity. Jeremiah 34, verse 17, dropping down in the same chapter. Jeremiah 34, verse 17. Therefore, thus says the Eternal, you've not obeyed me in proclaiming liberty, everyone to his brother and everyone to his neighbor. Behold, I proclaim liberty to you, says the Eternal. You won't give them their freedom. You're going to get your freedom. You're going to be dragged out of the city. That's the kind of freedom you're going to get. To the sword, to the pestilence, and to famine. And I will deliver you to trouble among all the kingdoms of the earth. And I will give the men who have transgressed my covenant, who have not performed the words of the covenant which they made before me, when they cut the calf in two and passed between the parts of it. Strange reference here. You remember Abraham back in Genesis chapter 17? Genesis 15, I think it was. We won't turn back there. But in Genesis 15, he did something very similar. God proposes a covenant to him, and he says, you take some sacrificial animals, you cut them in half, and it says he didn't cut the birds in half. You cut them in half, and you place one half of the animal on one side, one half of the animal on the other side, almost a little bit like the meeting hall that we're meeting in, with a kind of a corridor down the middle. This is one of the ways in which you entered into a covenant back then. You take sacrificed animals, hew them in half, and then the parties to the covenant would walk through the middle of the corridor, and they entered into a solemn commitment. Only problem here is they didn't live up to the terms and conditions of this covenant. Verse 19, Jeremiah 34, verse 19. The princes of Judah, the princes of Jerusalem, the eunuchs, the priests, and all the people of the land who passed between the parts of the calf. They made a covenant. They cut those animals in two and said, we're letting the slaves go free. And God said, this is a good thing. And guess what happened? The Egyptians succeeded in mustering their strength. And they kind of created a bit of a problem temporarily for the Babylonians, and they forced the Babylonians back. And then all of a sudden they say, okay, we're off the hook now. It's okay. We don't have to worry about it. And then they violated the terms of their own promise, and they took the slaves back. And really, this was a watershed event for Zedekiah because it kind of set the seal. Obvious lesson, keep your word no matter what. Keep your word no matter what. Verse 20. I will give them into the hand of their enemies and into the hand of those who seek their life. Their dead bodies shall be meat for the birds of the heaven and the beasts of the earth. And I will give Zedekiah and his princes into the hand of their enemies, into the hand of those who seek their life, and into the hand of the king of Babylon's army, which has gone back from you. Temporarily. Behold, I will command and cause them to return to this city. They will fight against it and take it and burn it with fire, and I will make the cities of Judah a desolation without inhabitant. He broke his word. He broke his word because he thought he got off the hook and he thought he could get away with it. And sometimes it can be hard to keep our words no matter what. And yet, of course, that's exactly what we're required to do as Christians. 2 Timothy 3, verse 4. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4. We'll come back to Jeremiah 34 briefly. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 4. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4. The description of people in the last days. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 4. Traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Back in verse 3. If you look in the Old King James Version, the word that's translated unforgiving in our New King James Version, that's where it uses that rather old-fashioned phrase, truce breakers. People in the last days will be truce breakers, covenant breakers. It's talking about people who give their word and don't follow through. You ever had anybody do that to you? Promise you they do something? It's a horrible feeling, isn't it? And certainly when we give our word to God, we follow through on it. We have to follow through on it. It looked as if Babylon was God, and it was gone. And then Jeremiah, it says, it's not over. It's not over. Are they going to come back? And Zedekiah did not believe Jeremiah. And he said, okay, it's over. He believed his advisors. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 7. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7. Very important little principle that we read here. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 7. You know, Jeremiah told Zedekiah that he needed to subject himself to Babylon. He needed to keep his word. He needed to do what was right before God. And all Zedekiah had was Jeremiah's word, and yet he was familiar with this prophet. He's been on the scene for some length of time. 2 Corinthians 5 verse 7 tells us we walk by faith, not by sight. Isn't that an important concept there? We walk by faith and not by sight. Sometimes doing what's right is not visible. You know, we don't see the visible outcome of it. We can't see how it will come out. Physical senses can lead us in one direction. Walking by faith, walking in spiritual faith, can lead us in a different direction. It was a big lesson that this rather sad king was not able to inculcate, was not able to put into effect as he was in that rather important leadership role with his nation. Babylon came back. The siege restarted, and it got really, really bad. And if we want to, we won't go to the Book of Lamentations. We actually covered it in FI Online about 3 years ago. But you can read there how bad it got. It got really, really bad. And Jeremiah's was that constant voice. And Zedekiah sort of didn't know what to do with him. Didn't know what to do with him. Didn't know how to relate to him. He respected Jeremiah. He comes to Jeremiah more than once, and he says, what's the word of the Lord? And Jeremiah tells him what the word of the Lord is. And he never quite has the courage to do what's right. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 38. Jeremiah 38. There's so many lessons in the life of this man. Negative lessons, but hopefully lessons that we can learn from nevertheless. Jeremiah 38, verses 14 through 19. Jeremiah 38, beginning in verse 14. This is almost right at the end. Look at the way it is in your Bible. Jeremiah 39 is the fall of Jerusalem, 586 BC. This is just before Jerusalem falls. And really, in a way, the seal is there. You know, the fate of Jerusalem is fixed. And once again, Zedekiah comes to Jeremiah the prophet and says, what has God got to say to me? And Jeremiah, who's consistent, tells him, what God says is you better subject yourself to Babylon. You can change history. You can change history if you do this. Jeremiah 38 and verse 14. Jeremiah 38 and verse 14. This gets to be even more interesting. Zedekiah the king sent and had Jeremiah the prophet brought to him at the third entrance of the house of the Eternal. And the king said to Jeremiah, I will ask you something. Hide nothing from me. You get the impression that Zedekiah is a bit ashamed even to be seen with Jeremiah. He's cautious about it. Jeremiah said to Zedekiah, "If I declare it to you, will you not surely put me to death?" God told Jeremiah at the beginning of the book that he would actually come through with his life, and he did. If I give you advice, you will not listen to me. You've not listened all these years. You're going to begin listening to me now. Zedekiah the king swore secretly to Jeremiah, saying, "As the Eternal lives, who made our very souls, I will not put you to death, nor will I give you into the hand of these men who seek your life." And Jeremiah said to Zedekiah, "Thus says the Eternal, the God of hosts, the King of Israel, if you surely surrender to the King of Babylon's princes, then your soul shall live." You can come through this. You don't have to die. You don't have to. Actually, at the end, you remember the story. He lost his sons, and they gouged his eyes and dragged him off into Babylonian captivity. Jeremiah says to him, "If you surrender, you can survive. This city shall not be burned with fire, and you and your house shall live. But if you do not surrender to the king of Babylon's princes, then this city shall be given into the hand of the Chaldeans. They shall burn it with fire, and you shall not escape from their hand." Look at verse 19. Look at verse 19 in this chapter. Zedekiah the king said to Jeremiah, "I'm afraid of the Jews who have defected to the Chaldeans." This came in waves. Some of them already gone over to the Babylonians. And Zedekiah, king of Judah, is held back from doing what's right because of fear for himself. "I'm afraid of the Jews who have defected to the Chaldeans, lest they deliver me into their hand and they abuse me. I'm worried for myself. I'm worried for myself. I'm afraid for me," is what Zedekiah says here. Self-interest. And, you know, we can, of course, apply that to politics in our world today. How many stories there are on the world scene, not just this country, but other countries as well, where politicians act out of self-interest. And Zedekiah kind of personifies this. He's concerned for himself. And he can't quite bring himself to do what's right. This is a man who could have changed history. History would have been different had he done the right thing. Verse 20, Jeremiah said, "They shall not deliver you. Please obey the voice of the Eternal which I speak to you, so it shall be well with you and your soul shall live. But if you refuse to surrender, this is what God has shown me." And he goes on to describe in some detail what would happen, to him. And then verse 24, Zedekiah said to Jeremiah, "Let no one know of these words, and you shall not die." Don't tell people. Don't tell people. I don't want them to know that I've been talking to the prophet of God. Zedekiah was a sad individual, frightened to do what was right, scared to do what was right. What will they do to me if I surrender to the Babylonians? Had he made the right decision, he could have changed history. But he was afraid to do what was right. John chapter 10. Let's go forward to the New Testament. John chapter 10. John chapter 10. And verses 11 through 14. John 10, verse 11. Contrast that last king of Judah with the King of Kings. John 10, verse 11. Jesus says here, "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep." That's sometimes what's required in service and in leadership. "But a hireling who is not the shepherd, one who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf catches the sheep and scatters them. The hireling flees because he is a hireling and does not care about the sheep. I'm the good shepherd, and I know my sheep, and am known by my own. As the Father knows me, even so I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep." Interesting statement there from Jesus Christ. Because Zedekiah was exactly the opposite. Concerned for himself, worried about his own well-being, and unable to get himself to make a good decision in the interests of his people. Look how many lessons there are in the life of this individual. He could have changed history. What would have happened, have you ever wondered about this? What would have happened if Zedekiah had done what was right, if he had submitted himself to the Babylonians? Well, maybe The Babylonian conquest would have come later on. You know, if it had gone downhill and there had been more bad kings after him. But he would at least have put off and postponed the captivity. He could have changed history. But he was weak. He was passive. He was unable to kind of gather his strength, gather his commitment, and do what was right to save his own people. Jeremiah chapter 39. Jeremiah 39, verses 1 through 7. Jeremiah 39, verse 1. In the ninth year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the tenth month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army came against Jerusalem and besieged it. In the 11th year of Zedekiah, in the fourth month, on the ninth of the month, the city was penetrated. And all the princes of the king of Babylon came in and sat in the middle gate. It's interesting, the Bible tells you exactly where they were. And it gives the name of these Babylonian officials. Nergal Sharezer, Samgar Nebo. Look at those names, by the way. You've got names of Babylonian gods embedded there. With the rest of the princes of the king of Babylon, verse 4. So it was when Zedekiah, king of Judah, and all the men of war saw them, that they fled and went out of the city by night by way of the king's garden, by the gate between the two walls, and he went out by way of the plain. He's trying to flee, trying to save his own life, not concerned with the lives of his people, the people whom he was supposed to serve. But the Chaldean army pursued them and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. And when they had captured him, they brought him up to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, to Riblah in the land of Hamath, where he pronounced judgment on him. He has this kind of face-to-face confrontation with Nebuchadnezzar north of Jerusalem. Riblah was north of Jerusalem. The king of Babylon killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes in Riblah. The king of Babylon also killed all the nobles of Judah. Moreover, he put out Zedekiah's eyes, and he bound him with bronze fetters and carried him off to Babylon, and he lived out his life in misery. He wasn't put to death. Jeremiah told him he wouldn't be put to death, and he wasn't. But he lived out his life in misery. And verse 8, the Chaldeans burned the king's house and the houses of the people with fire and broke down the walls of Jerusalem. And Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive to Babylon the remnant of the people who remained in the city and those who defected to him with the rest of the people who remained. Remarkable story there. This man was given an opportunity, like us. You know, the Bible talks about us as kings and priests as well. He could have changed history. He could have made the Bible read in a different way. But he couldn't quite muster the strength and muster the integrity to do what was right in God's sight. Lots of lessons there. History altering destiny. Lots of lessons there from the life of this last king of Judah, King Zedekiah.